I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. After Genocide Joe Biden's catastrophic 4 years, notable for a live-streamed Holocaust in West Asia, the promotion of wars on Russia via Ukraine, China via Taiwan, could today signal what Donald Trump has called the beginning of a golden age. What tricks did the military-industrial complex have to subvert the 47th president of the USA as he is inaugurated in Washington, D.C.? Joining me again from the U.S. Capitol is Doug Bandow, former Special Assistant to U.S. President Ronald Reagan and now Senior Fellow at the Washington think tank, the Cato Institute. Doug, thanks so much for coming back on 44 years ago today that your old boss Reagan was inaugurated. I mean, you're in the Beltway. On Saturday's Going Underground, I spoke to former Congressman Dennis Kucinich, who ran actually a presidential campaign for RFK Jr., who was then appointed to a Trump cabinet position, who's going to be in the government. What do you get from... what's your feeling about how Trump is going to rein in appointees that despise him, perhaps, based on what you've seen of confirmation hearings and these very, some would say, if you're a big MAGA Republican, very strange appointments like Marco Rubio, his national security advisor, Waltz, even his new head of the CIA, Radcliffe, all these nominees?
Well, I certainly assume that he learned his lesson from the first administration, that when you nominate people, if you don't monitor them closely, they go off and do their own agenda. Part of this, I think, is the fact that he's really not consistent in his thinking. He's willing to intervene at different points. We've seen him blustering about Greenland and Canada and Panama Canal. So I think within, he doesn't come to this with a clear, simple ideology. But he certainly wants it done his way. And I think we've seen what appears to be a tougher stance towards Benjamin Netanyahu, for example, than anyone expected. So Trump has the ability to surprise. So I think this go around, he's learned he's got to tell his folks, do it his way. The question is, can he manage that? Can he keep the attention span? Can he focus on it? Is he willing to switch them out if they don't do that? All of these are unanswered questions, but he's not a dummy, and he certainly saw what happened the first go-around. He's commented about John Bolton and others who undermined him at almost any opportunity. So one has to believe he's taken that into account. He's been much more disciplined coming into this inauguration than the previous one in terms of making appointments early, choosing people, including controversial ones, whether it's Robert Kennedy Jr., whether it's Tulsi Gabbard, that he certainly seems to know what he's doing this occasion.
Yeah, you mentioned the Gaza ceasefire plan. I mean, taking on that lobby, the Israel lobby in Washington, D.C., is quite a big first. And some people might not have expected Steve Witkoff, big Zionist, to have done that. I mean, obviously, we heard from Biden trying to claim credit, tragic credit, arguably, over the bodies of so many, mostly women and children. Do you think that gives us a sign that he's willing to take on some of the toughest lobbies there are? Because clearly, I mean, it's obviously also the anniversary of the Eisenhower military-industrial complex speech. I mean, I've seen some arms companies' share prices declining. Do you think that he wants peace? Is he really the peace president that he campaigned as?
I think he is. Now, in saying that, that doesn't mean that he doesn't want to wander around the world doing things and that he's not willing to kind of try to assert American power and make threats.
Yeah, you said Greenland and Panama, actually. You might want to go into that because, I mean, they are strategic decisions.
That's right. I mean, almost any American security analyst would say there are reasons for the United States to care about what happens to both the Panama Canal and Greenland. But virtually none of them would say that you kind of show up and threaten Denmark that you might seize Greenland, or you seem to be implying that we'll use military force if we want to take the Panama Canal back. But of course, part of that, I think, is seeking leverage. Now, it shows that he has this unilateralist impulse to him, where the U.S. is a great power and it needs to do what it needs to do. But I think part of that is he really doesn't want to go to war. And I think we have to give him credit. The way he talks, for example, is, he talks about the loss of life in Ukraine and how terrible that is. Well, frankly, most, you know, American presidents don't worry an awful lot about people dying in other countries. George W. Bush never spent a lot of time lamenting the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who died after the U.S. invasion. And, you know, 8 years ago when Trump ran, he gave a foreign policy speech. And in that, at one point, he talked about aggression and criticized U.S. policy in places like Iraq. So I think buried within Trump's bluster really is a desire to make sure Americans aren't dying in stupid wars, and he'd prefer other people not die as well. But he really doesn't want to get the U.S. involved in a war. He's talked about the dangers of nuclear war. He recognizes what could happen, you know, in terms of Ukraine, Russia, if that went, you know, into a war with NATO. So I think this is very real. Again, he doesn't have a clear philosophy exactly how to make it happen, but I think we should give him credit that more than I think any at least recent president, certainly Joe Biden, he really worries about these issues in a way that the others haven't.
I feel like I'm a bit like Judge Napolitano here, if anyone's watching his podcast, because I asked Dennis Kucinich, former congressman, this as well, as I'm going to ask you the question, basically, on Saturday's show, and he was more optimistic than anyone could have hoped about Trump's ability to control this cabinet that he's appointed. But doesn't it just take one piece of paper from his new CIA boss, if he's confirmed, Radcliffe, who worked with John Ashcroft, to say, oh, Iran is behind an assassination attempt. Actually, they already tried that on him. It takes how much for Rubio to say, oh, Maduro is doing this in Venezuela, or Waltz, his national security advisor, to say something about Taiwan, or there to be some kind of blowback for the catastrophic record of the Biden administration, whether it be Al-Qaeda weapons coming all the way from Syria now, that's the legacy of the Obama years, hitting the homeland, the United States, or weapons to Nazis in Ukraine, hitting the homeland. Well, all it takes is that, and doesn't it just throw Trump off course? Or is he savvy enough to realize he doesn't want to be played again?
Well, I have a sense that coming out of his first administration, he realizes he was played. You know, that he realizes people use this. I think it's one reason he wants Tulsi Gabbard in at intelligence. That if Tulsi Gabbard is there, she's very likely to take a different view and very likely to be more wary and helping kind of bolster him in terms of where you look for the people who are doing what you want and you look for the folks trying to manipulate you. I mean, I share that concern because I worry there are too many around him that you hate to think of both the Secretary of State and the National Security Advisor. Then if you toss in the CIA director, if they decide to come up with a common front, is he prepared to buck that? But he certainly, again, if we look at the way he took on Netanyahu, I mean, you know, Biden claimed, of course, it's all fake, but Biden claimed to be, you know, oh, this is terrible. We need to, you know, get a ceasefire, but applied no pressure at all. You know, the deal that they've talked about, which we, you know, is one that could have been had months ago if the U.S. had put pressure on Netanyahu, and it didn't. And from everything we see is that Trump actually did. So again, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu is one who, look, spent a lot of time saying you should go to war with Iran. You've got to do all this other stuff. It looks to me like, you know, that Trump recognizes that and says, yeah, I know where he's coming from. That's not my policy. So I'm hopeful. I mean, again, we need to be very cautious. You know, Donald Trump is an acquired taste. He's unique in the way he does things. But that uniqueness gives us an opportunity we certainly haven't had the last 4 years or the 8 years before the first Trump administration.
Yeah, the legacy of the Biden genocide is going to be a long one, especially in this region. But since you refer to it again, I don't know whether it's his Arab-American son-in-law. But, I mean, in that deal, he's possibly going against Tulsi Gabbard and RFK Jr., who are avowed Zionists in one sense, and Miriam Adelson, the big donor to his campaign. Can he really fight those forces? I mean, I know you believe that, as far as I understand it, Tulsi Gabbard poses the promise of something different and something truly make America great again as regards foreign policy and therefore home policy. Does it show how independent Trump intends on being?
Well, what I would bet here is that Trump realizes he's shown his bona fides. No Israeli can come to him and say, you're selling out Israel. He's going to say, look, I moved the capital to Jerusalem. I did this. I did that. You know, I came up with that, deal of the century plan that really sold the Palestinians out. But he can say, I did all this stuff for Israel. You can't accuse me of that. But he has, at some level, I think, some credibility. And it looks to me like he's decided to use that credibility. And we may very well, I remember at one moment in the 2016 campaign, he talked about the importance of fairness to the Palestinians. Again, a sentiment you didn't usually hear American presidential candidates talk about. And then that disappeared. And he kind of went off and went into the very strong pro-Israel, whatever they want mode. But you can look back at that and think, well, maybe again, buried within him is he sees what's happening in the West Bank today. He saw the rubble. It could have been a nuclear war of the destruction in Gaza. That I have to believe this had an impact on him, and that while he might have Americans saying it doesn't really matter, of course Israel had to do it, if he's looking at the death toll, he's looking at what remains, my guess is that that probably touched him. Then that may very well be part of this notion that we need a ceasefire and we need it now. And it was Ronald Reagan in Beirut, Ronald Reagan with Lebanon, who did that to Israel and Menachem Begin. Where Israel had invaded horrible stuff in Lebanon, and Reagan basically said, stop it. And they did. That had an impact on Israel. So maybe, Trump looked back on that and said, yeah, there's a chance. You can be very conservative. You can be in favor of Israel, but you can also say, end this war, stop killing the civilians.
Yeah, that's what Reagan did in that event. I saw that already the Attorney General nominee, Pam Bondi, was being attacked for the FBI nominee, Kash Patel, saying that some people that have lied in the past, they need to be brought to justice. Do you think there will be some kind of bringing to justice of all the people, not only that have lied about the Trump administration, the Russiagate hoax, but also those people that destroyed the Ukraine deal, which came, there was a deal in Turkey in March 2022. Boris Johnson, MI6 apparently, involved. I mean, are they going to go over all of that while they are trying to forge peace so that never again can US policy be abrogated to the benefit, not of the American people?
Well, it's hard to know exactly where he wants to go with this. I think he certainly would like to go after people who he believes broke the law in going after him in terms of what they did on policy. What I would hope is that he might kind of break this up into two different, in a sense, groups. One group is to investigate, recognizing there's probably not a formal legal, issue here in which you can indict someone, but you certainly want to investigate. And the second would be go after people who really have, it would appear, committed perjury, lied, and whatnot. I mean, we should know about what happened in terms of, when a whole bunch of, these security officials came together in 2020 saying, Hunter Biden's laptop. No, that wasn't his. That's Russian disinformation. And then after the election, the New York Times runs a story and said, oh, guess what? It looks like that was really Hunter Biden's after all. Well, what are all these security officials in terms of security agencies and stuff doing? It would appear jumping into a presidential campaign, those are places where I think you probably at least want to investigate. I think he wants to be careful how far he pushes prosecution. And, he's talked about it, but I certainly haven't seen that as being a big emphasis of his, in the last couple of months. So we'll have to see where they go. I mean, his choice of FBI or of Justice Department, of the Attorney General, I mean, it strikes me as a measured person in terms of her background, doesn't look like somebody who's going to go off and do crazy things. And that's what he needs, is somebody who's measured who can make the appointment.
Doug Bando, I'll stop you there. More from the former special assistant to U.S. President Ronald Reagan after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the former special assistant to U.S. President Ronald Reagan and senior fellow at the Cato Institute, Doug Bando. Doug, at the end of part one, you mentioned the Hunter Biden laptop. I should say Going Underground on U.S. Election Day some time back had Rudy Giuliani on, the former mayor of New York. And I'm afraid to say even we couldn't believe the laptop that he showed on this program. I think we can be forgiven for that because it was such an explosive story. But when it comes to bringing to justice all those who lied about, who tried to make out it didn't happen, that there was no role of the Biden so-called crime family as regards Ukraine, and the censorship that takes place in your country, do you expect Trump to really rejig your country again so that it abides by the First Amendment again, and we don't see the kind of censorship that has gone on for years now in violation, gross violation, some would say, of your Constitution?
Well, I think we are certainly going to see action taken to prevent government agencies from pressuring digital companies to suddenly censor stuff. And we've seen progress on this. Again, I think the mere election of Trump and the recognition that Trump was elected by, he actually won the popular vote as well as the Electoral College. But anyone looking at that election and seeing virtually every demographic group, including minorities, moving towards Trump, I think really put a message in there to, whether you call it the deep state, whatever you want to call it, the American people are tired of this. So we see Facebook. I mean, oh my goodness, the announcement, and commenting about, well, the election kind of shows some things, and so much for kind of our monitoring and everything else. It's suddenly fact-checking by the biased fact-checkers is going out. That, I think, is a very important step. And my hope is that we're going to see some others follow suit. And this is an obvious place for the Justice Department in terms of, as you indicate, a lot of these are things where they try to get around the First Amendment by saying, oh, it's not us, it's a private company. But where you have government putting that pressure on, and we certainly saw that with Facebook, that's a place the Justice Department can go in. And again, at the very least, an investigation highlighting this, pointing out how dangerous this is to potentially new legislation. With Republicans in control of both houses of Congress, with the president, this would be a place to put new federal rules in. If government agents can't do this, that appointments can't do this. So I'm hopeful, because you're quite right. What's extraordinary is a country that's always had a robust environment for free speech. What we saw going on in the last few years has been extraordinary and outrageous.
And oligarchs, rogue oligarchs, arguably like Zuckerberg, should just be forgiven, even though they knew they were being pressured by the government. So they weren't really private companies. They were acting as government agents. They should just be forgiven? You think it's that easy for these people to be forgiven after the lies they told about Trump and the attempted subversion of the Trump policy schedule, as it were?
Well, I wouldn't forgive and forget. I think the problem here is it's not at all clear there's any legal remedy. But I think this is where you shame them. And you take the Zuckerberg and you say, well, it's nice that you've turned around on this, but how do we put in rules that ensure this doesn't happen again? And you use his example, and you should go out now to the other digital companies and say, okay, what about YouTube? What about Amazon? What about kind of go down the list? We know this is happening. We've already had the confession from Zuckerberg. When are you all going to come clean? I mean, it was so useful, it turns out, to have had, Twitter or now X taken over, because we got to find out the details of how this was conducted in X, and where suddenly X has become a truth teller rather than basically a captive of the deep state.
It's certainly better than it was, but Google, YouTube still... as far as we know, using algorithms to suppress the kind of views that the American people, as you say, voted in a popular vote. I don't know whether they could break it up like Bell Telephone or something, Google and companies like that. Clearly, they pose a danger to free speech in the power that concentrated in the board of Google.
It's hard. There are other search engines out there, so you can argue that there's a marketplace. In fact, Google's gotten such a share.
Except their government contractors, their government defense contractors. Amazon is one, Google is one. They work for the Pentagon. For Pete Hegseth, actually, they'll be working for.
I mean, that's and it shows the problem of the military-industrial complex. I mean, Eisenhower was very prescient in his warnings. Where, universities get, defense department funding. This is pervasive. And you're right, it takes agents, it turns agents into something other than private entities if they rely so heavily on the feds. And then it's hard for them to say no when, you know, whoever the president or any of his minions call up. And lo and behold, we see what they do to the American people.
You see, if he really does try to get a peace with Russia over Ukraine, perhaps restarts START and the INF treaties and so on, and tries to seek peace in this way, he simultaneously wants to open up the JFK papers, which some believe may show government duplicity, even far beyond already suspected. I mean, would they not try and kill him? And does he, do you think, fear that they will try and kill him for opposing this, as you say, Eisenhower military-industrial complex that Eisenhower himself was too weak to fight?
No, it's a legitimate concern. I mean, we saw how what would appear to have been incompetence on the part of the Secret Service. I mean, very lucky he survived that one assassination attempt. And then there was, of course, the second where the assassin set himself up and they got to him before he fired a shot. But I mean, the extraordinary blunders, and again, one, you know, there are people who think that that was intended. I don't. I think it was incompetence. But one could understand why he'd have to worry that there are so many who are offended by his policies that, you know, who knows what they might try. And certainly from the military-industrial standpoint, they want the wars to keep going. The worst thing for them would be to have peace, you know, break out and not have everyone ordering all the extra munitions.
I mean, obviously, Hegseth hasn't been confirmed at the time of this interview. Do you believe that the smear, I mean, rather than assassination, it is usually smear tactics that are used, obviously against Trump himself, courtesy of Christopher Steele, the MI6 agent, who I don't know, they might need to look into him. Do you think Tulsi Gabbard will be confirmed? I mean, you've seen the kind of level of propaganda that she is somehow working for Vladimir Putin in between being in uniform. I'm not sure. What's your personal reaction to that, that kind of smear tactic throughout New York Times, Washington Post?
It's grotesque stuff. I mean, whenever I point out how, you know, NATO officials, American officials helped set up, you know, this tragic war, you know, it's, those are Putin's talking points. And I tell people that the issue is not whether they're Putin's talking points. The question is, are they the truth? That, you know, if you're not able to criticize your own leaders and point out where they have blundered, and he blundered in a way where we're talking about tens or hundreds of thousands of dead because of their blunders, that, you know, this is a real problem. None of them want the truth out. You know, and we've seen, I mean, now I think it's that Poland has accused Russia of wanting to have terrorist attacks on airplanes. I mean, this looks to me like just another attempt to try to prevent some sort of a negotiated settlement. You throw anything out there. I mean, we know when they were accusing Russia of having blown up its own pipeline. I wrote an article at the time saying this was nonsense. And it was published, but it was published with a prescript that said, you know, this is only the writer's viewpoint. We publish lots of different stuff. They didn't put that on any other article I wrote. They never put that on any other article by anyone that I'm aware of. You know, it shows the sensitivity there that, you know, even people who are supposedly part of a free press get very nervous about talking about the truth. So he has to be wary. I hope he starts out heavy. That is, make these disclosures, you know, kind of allow the stuff to come out. You know, do this early on so you've got it done, as opposed to them thinking they can prevent it. You want to do this early and basically, you know, bring out everything that's there, and then that's the way to undermine them and talk about further disclosures.
Yeah, Seymour Hersh came on this show to talk about his revelations about the Nord Stream pipeline bombing. Do you think we'll see any justice as regards that operation? Probably not, because it's the CIA, but will we see any justice brought about the people and structures involved in getting the United States Treasury basically involved in killing de facto so many hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian people on an altar of, I don't know, failed NATO expansion?
Well, he certainly should. And again, he's talked about, he recognizes the role of NATO. So this is a perfect opportunity for him to move forward and say, never again are we going to do this. You know, never, you know, that he can talk about, you know, American exceptionalism and what America needs to do for its own security. And that's a potential for him to say, what was done in Europe was not that. and point out how a new American foreign policy, you know, can be assertive on the part of the United States, but how the U.S. should be very much against wars and recognizing how its own actions can help promote that. So I think he should take the lead on that. He recognizes the truth. And that's one of the advantages with him.
I mean, indications are that he hasn't said that he's definitely going to rescind Biden's permission to fire long-range missiles, United States missiles, at Moscow. Keith Kellogg, ex-COO of the Iraq Coalition Provisional Authority, is the Trump nominee regarding Ukraine. I mean, how long is he going to last, the Kellogg's cornflakes heir? I don't know, maybe you know him. I mean, how long is he going to last, and how do they think they're going to be bargaining with Russia over long-range missile attack permissions given by the Biden administration? I mean, Putin's going to want more than that, surely.
Oh, of course. I'm sure there are some arguments being made that Trump should kind of pocket this as leverage and use that in upcoming negotiations. But I think you're right. Putin is not going to give up what he views as a central interest for Russia over something like this. And he's made it very clear that, you know, if these are used, that they are prepared to retaliate. And Putin has a very good alternative, which is to say, if you all do this, you know, we can make sure that the North Koreans can target your country with ICBMs. You know, we can help them with their projects. Is that what you want? So I would assume there might be some hard bargaining to come, that the whip hand here is not held by the United States, frankly. I think it's Moscow has a much better deal that they can offer.
Doug Bando, thank you.
You're welcome.
That's it for the show. We'll be back with a brand new episode on Saturday. But until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.